Welcome, friends. This is Economic Update, a weekly program of economic analysis that looks at the jobs, the incomes, the debts, the hopes for our children's future that involve everything having to do with the economy, that system of producing the goods and services that we all depend on. I'm your host, Richard Wolff. I've been a professor of economics all my adult life at several universities. Today I teach at the New School University in New York City. I also write regular columns of economic analysis, particularly for truthout.org, an independent and courageous source of news and analysis every day. I urge you to take a look at truthout.org to get a sense of the important functions they perform. If you're interested in this kind of programming, if the analyses and updates that we provide are of interest, I urge you also to visit the two websites that we maintain, rdwolf.com and democracyatwork.info. Both of those websites contain audio, video, and written files that give you a sense of the developments in our economy. They also provide lectures, entire semester-long classes, and a host of other related services. In addition, these two websites, again, rdwolf.com and democracyatwork.info, provide you with a way to communicate to us about this program, questions you have, and comments. And finally, they allow you, by clicking on an icon, to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Pinterest in order to be kept up to date on an even more regular, ongoing basis. Before beginning today, I want to thank the many of you that have responded over recent weeks to the following information. We are interested in expanding the number of radio stations that carry this program. We are extremely gratified that over the 3.5 years that we've been doing this program, we've gone from one station, WBAI, in New York City, to 35 stations across the United States and also Canada. But we would like to double and triple that number of stations, and we urge those of you that know about or have contacts at any local station, public radio, community radio, university or college radio, it really doesn't matter to us. Outreach is what we're after. Let us know. Use the websites to communicate to us advice, contacts, leads, phone numbers, whatever. We'd be much obliged. And the same applies to my speaking schedule. Later in this program, I'll mention a recent trip I made and speeches that I gave, but we are interested in having me do that as well. So that if you have a university or college audience, a labor union, a community group, and would like to have me come and speak again, please use the websites to communicate that to us. I can think of no better way to introduce today's program than to tell you the story about a remarkable employee of an American bank. His name is Tyrell Oates, O-A-T-E-S. He's been an employee for the last 7 years of the Wells Fargo Bank, one of the largest banks in the United States, an outfit that has, if I understand correctly, over 200,000 employees. Tyrell Oates became famous over the last week by sending an email to the president of the company, the CEO, Mr. John Stumpf, S-T-U-M-P-F. In that email, he asked for more money. He urged Mr. Stumpf to use the enormous resources of the bank to provide a decent living for many of the employees, and he used himself as an example. Here's the information about him. He's 31 years of age, has a responsible career, and earns all of $15 an hour. And that works out for a 40-hour week of $600 a week. He's been working for 7 years, during which time his salary went from $13 an hour to $15 an hour. Wow. Can't do much with that amount of money. So he asked for more, but he was generous and asked not only for himself, but for the other 200,000 and plus employees. He was mindful, as I am going to make all of us, of what it is that is earned, how much money is earned by Mr. Strumpf, the CEO of Wells Fargo. Last year, his salary and bonus came to $19.3 million. And over the last several years, his salary has gone up by about 40%, whereas Mr. Oates's hasn't gone up anywhere near that percentage. Well, I did a little arithmetic because I found it so interesting. Mr. Oates makes $600 a week. So I calculated, how much does Mr. Strumpf earn per week? Here it is, $375,000 every week. $600 writes an email asking for more money to a person who earns $375,000 per week. What did Mr. Strumpf answer? I couldn't possibly do justice to this, so I'm simply going to read to you the answer that Mr. Oates got. Here we go. And this is a winner for sheer corporate gobbledygook. The answer, of course, was no. But here's how it was worded. Quote, "We provide market competitive compensation that combines base pay with a broad array of benefits and career development opportunities for team members." No comment, and no comment needed. Updates for early October 2014. Well, believe it or not, General Motors, but also Ford Motor Company, announced huge, you guessed it, callbacks. They're going to have to fix yet more cars numbering more than a million between them. General Motors, unbelievably, is now over 30 million cars recalled for a variety of failures, mistakes, inadequate operation, some of which life-threatening. Some of which have taken lives. Ford Motor joined them with another million this last week. Again, I will say what I have said before, but cannot be said too often. Any private enterprise that has, over the last few years, like General Motors, required bailout by the people of this country to the tune of over $50 billion, that not only took all that public money to continue, but in a sense rewarded us by producing stunningly inadequate cars, despite having a safety division and a supervision division and all the rest, is a kind of private enterprise that has forfeited its right to continue. It is a danger and a cost to the public. And the very least that ought to happen in this country is a serious conversation about whether we as a people can continue to live in an economic system that gives to private enterprise not only the extraordinary freedoms we provide, but bailouts when they make catastrophic mistakes, and no conversation about taking them over and running them in the public interest when they produce faulty automobiles on the scale of General Motors, now joined by Ford. That debate is long overdue. I also thought it might be interesting for folks to know that another major tech company has decided that the contribution it can make to an economy that's struggling is to make the economy worse off. Hewlett-Packard, a major producer of computer-related equipment, announced the layoff of 55,000 employees as it seeks to become more profitable by splitting into two separate companies. Thank you, Hewlett-Packard. You clearly have the welfare of this society uppermost in your mind. Third economic update I wanted to mention to you today is an interesting economic story that has a lesson in it for us. Many years ago, there was a revolution in Cuba, 1959. Fidel Castro came to power. Fulgencio Batista left. He was a classic Latin American dictator, and Cuba went through a major change that we have followed as a nation ever since. Shortly after that revolution, many Cubans, particularly those with higher incomes, left Cuba, mostly to go to the United States. Among them were about half the medical doctors in Cuba. They had roughly 6,000 doctors at the time, and roughly 3,000 left. This, of course, produced a medical emergency in Cuba. They could not provide for the medical care of their people if half their doctors in a very short time left the country. Try to imagine what that might mean here in the United States or in Canada or in any other country. So the Cuban government went to work to try to deal with this problem. And what they did was decide to begin a massive program across Cuba to train doctors, nurses, but a whole host of other medical personnel, some with a minimal of training, some with more, to get a solution to the problem. And they were, by and large, successful. And then the Cubans discovered that if a society invests in something as fundamentally necessary and useful as the medical care of its people, it may encounter the opportunity for gains way beyond merely providing decent medical care to the Cuban people. And as all surveys of the World Health Organization have shown, Cuba, despite its relative poverty, and despite its being a small country, and despite the embargo against it the United States has maintained for the last 40 years, has one of the best medical histories and records anywhere in the world, and it's clearly because of the enormous government influence. But it became an economically profitable sector, and that's why I'm talking about it. The proof emerged this last couple of weeks when it turns out that the largest contingent of medical personnel yet to arrive in West Africa to begin to deal with the frightening Ebola epidemic was the team, you guessed it, from Cuba, larger than anything sent by Britain, the United States, China, or anywhere else. And why is it that the Cubans are able to send such teams? Because of what they did, first of all, for their own people, and then they discovered that the whole world needs what Cuba was able to achieve. Thus, today, the following statistic. 1. Cuban-trained medical personnel are currently active in 66 countries around the world. 2. Cuba uses the export of trained medical personnel as a way to pay for crucial imports into Cuba. Cuba, for example, needs oil to run any modern economy you do. It gets its oil from Venezuela and pays for it by sending thousands of medical-trained personnel to provide medical care to the Venezuelan people. After sugar and tourism, the export of medically-trained people for various periods of time to help out and to train others is the third most important source of foreign exchange for the Cuban economy. An interesting lesson in the complicated benefits that would arise from an investment in a social service that by itself isn't profitable, but that can have ramifications that are indeed profitable. Next item. Germany, in the last 2 weeks, reached a milestone. One of the subdivisions of Germany, they're called Länder, they're not states like we have in the United States. They're called technically lands within Germany. The last one, Saxony, eradicated the final remaining fee attached to higher education. Thus, the Germans can and do boast right now that for someone to attend college or university in Germany, the tuition is zero, and the number of fees outside and separate from tuition, is now also zero. Higher education in Germany costs you nothing. That means you do not incur anything like the debts that we have here in the United States that more and more college and university students have to carry. Free education, because as Germany notes, a modern civilized society is blessed by having educated people. Everyone benefits, and so it is appropriate to make it something like a public park. Everybody benefits from having a place for a picnic, having a place for a walk, having the benefit of trees and plants to improve the air, so we, at public expense, maintain parks. They believe that the benefits from higher education are at least as worthy of public support. Let me turn now to some of the major discussions scheduled for today's program as we transition, as we always do, from the shorter updates to the bigger ones. Many of you have asked me in your communications to our websites, and again, thank you for those, to talk about economics education in the United States, to talk about what it's been like, what its shortcomings are. And you've asked about the shortcomings because many of you have noticed correctly that the literacy, the economic literacy of Americans particularly, is poor. Very little is understood about how the economy works, and more than ever, because it is not working very well for most people, there's a growing hunger to understand why that is and what can be done about it, because it's causing real pain and real suffering on a massive social scale. So let me describe it to you. Basically, in the United States, before World War II, economics was one of those topics taught in virtually all colleges and universities, as it still is. But it was taught with a kind of breadth. The kinds of questions asked were, what makes some nations rich and other nations poor? What makes some individuals rich and others poor? How do you account for what happens to a company when it goes bankrupt? How do you account for a company that grows? All the kinds of basic questions like that. And then further broad questions. How does an economic system shape the politics and culture of a society, and vice versa? How is economics shaped by politics and culture? These kinds of broad questions with people who knew they were going to have to live in the economy like they have to live in the political and cultural life of their society and wanted to go to a university which would teach them how it works. Okay, that's what economics was about. The greatest writers addressed these kinds of broad questions. Thousands of students enrolled in economics courses to learn about these things. What causes a depression or an inflation? Why do these things happen? What does government do in the face of this sort of crisis that seems to happen so often? And indeed, why do economic upturns and downturns bedevil our capitalist economic system? But then after World War II, economics changed to be what it still is today, and it's that I want to focus your attention on. By far the most important impact or change that affected economics education after World War II was what we now call the Cold War, the kind of endless structured opposition between the United States on the one hand and the Soviet Union on the other. Capitalism in the United States against socialism in first Russia and then Eastern Europe and then China and so on. Excuse me. What the Cold War did was make it effectively impossible for economics to continue in anything remotely like a balanced way to talk about capitalism's strengths, but also its weaknesses, its achievements, but also its failures. And it certainly became impossible to systematically and honestly and openly compare the strengths and weaknesses of capitalism on the one hand with other economic systems like socialism on the other. What happened instead was to talk about socialism in anything other than a dismissive way was considered to be virtually treasonous. To talk about capitalism's weakness became some kind of disrespect for the flag or for the United States or something like that. We hadn't had that problem before, even though the Soviet Union has existed since 1917. But we had it after World War II, big time. And the economics profession accommodated the Cold War by effectively doing two things. One, making the discussion of capitalism not an evaluation of strengths and weaknesses, not a balanced appreciation, but instead a kind of endless cheerleading. Capitalism was efficient. Capitalism makes for economic growth. Capitalism is a rising tide that lifts all boats, and so on and so on and so on. My colleagues in the economics profession developed complicated arithmetic models to show how stable, how efficient, and then the word they loved most, how optimal capitalism was. Free markets were the best thing since sliced bread. Private enterprise, close second to markets, etc., etc., etc. The failures of capitalism, the absurd every 3 to 4 year economic downturn that throws millions of people out of work, we were told that that was no longer a problem, or it was simply ignored. The inequality that capitalism breeds, sustains, and worsens was ignored. Very few academics attended to it, and if they did, they always found that capitalism was not the problem. It was something else. Immigrants who somehow didn't have what it takes to make it. Government intervention. You know all the scapegoat candidates to excuse an honest appraisal of capitalism. And if socialism was ever discussed, and that was rare, it was discussed with a dismissive attitude very briefly to make sure that students heard everything good they could about capitalism, nothing bad, and the reverse for socialism. This was childish, this taboo, unreasonable conversation, but it became the absolute necessity. And it bred a generation of economists who were very poor on understanding how, when, where, and why the deficits of capitalism occur, the failures, the weaknesses, and the breakdowns. One of the reasons we're not doing real well handling the crisis now is precisely because it's being handled by a generation of economists very poorly educated in the problems of capitalism, to say the least. The metaphor I have used many times, and which I would like to ask you to listen to once again, is this. If we want to study a family living up the street, mama, papa, and two kids, and we learn that one of the kids thinks it's the greatest family there ever was, but the other child thinks it's a dysfunctional family with severe problems. If we want to understand the family, would we speak only to one of the two children? Would we explore the family through the lens of only one of the two children? And the answer is obviously, we wouldn't. We would need to see how the family is understood through the lens of a child who's very favorable and also the lens of a child who's critical. We then make up our own minds, having looked at the situation from the vantage point of two knowledgeable folks trying to give their own understanding of what this family is. Well, the economy is the same. You want to understand it, you study the way it looks through the lens of people who love capitalism. But you also study it through the lens of people who are critical and think that an economy can and should do better. To only talk to one, which is effectively what we've done in our economics departments for the last 50 years, is an inadequate, biased, unfair, one-sided, and lopsided way to train a generation or two of young people trying to understand our economy. The second problem of economics over the last 50 years has been the fact that inside the university, economics departments noticed something after World War II that nobody could miss. the favor of the university administrators, the budgets, the money given to each of the competing departments in a university, English versus physics versus economics versus philosophy, and so on. The competition of departments for money from the university to operate, to hire professors, to run their courses. It was clear that what administrators favored after World War II were the so-called hard sciences, mathematics, physics, chemistry, and biology. And economics looked at that situation and said, we've got to be more like them so we can get the money to operate. And more like them meant more scientific, more mathematical. So dramatically after World War II, economists used arithmetic and mathematics, making it more and more alien and difficult for people whose mental capability turns more to the sophisticated problems of social analysis, to understanding philosophic concepts, to questioning how we reason as people, to raise all of those most fundamental questions that science can't deal with, or certainly not deal with in an adequate way. All of that was forgotten, and economics became more and more technical. And what this did was to discourage the students who came in with the big, broad questions, the kinds of questions that had nurtured economics from its beginning in the 18th century up until World War II. Those students found the technical economics full of mathematics to be something that was not answering the questions they had. The students who stayed were the students who like to do technical work, engineering type students. There's, of course, a place for that in our culture. Why not? But to narrow economics down to just the technical dimensions, which is largely what happened, is to exclude not only the substantive questions our society needs answered, but also the kinds of students that could productively explore those questions. And finally, economists wanted to get their hands, as all academics do, on some of that federal money without which higher education has not functioned in the last 50 years. So they became eager to advise the government about how to fix the economy when it was so often broken, when it was so often not working well. Well, they said, we economists, we do this technical work, we can fix it. It's sort of like your car doesn't work, get a mechanic to fix the carburetor. Your economy doesn't work, get an economist to raise an interest rate or to change a regulation. The kind of practical economics advice to the government. These were the priorities of education. Asking the profound questions, does capitalism work? Whom does it serve? Does it work in ways that we literally can't do better than? Do we have to resign ourselves to the levels of inequality and inefficiency? Do we really have to accept that 30 million cars are called back because the three companies we entrust with producing them can't do the job? Or can we do better? Can we have serious criticism of economics as in a capitalist system, to see where and how changes can be made? These kinds of questions have been taboo, and the economics profession has become either highly technical or simply serving the government to maintain the status quo, or purely what we call apologetic, an endless succession of folks who celebrate capitalism. It is so far removed from really understanding how an economy works in anything remotely like a balanced, honest, objective way, that economics has one more peculiarity as an educational system that I want to draw to your attention. Even the world of American business is frustrated with economics. Oh, sure, they like that economists celebrate capitalism. But that's what they see it doing, celebrating. They don't teach, say many business professors, what the economy is really like. They just cheerlead for it. But we need young people to be able to know how the economy actually works if they're going to work in the real economy, solving the real problems that real businesses face. And so we have in economics a peculiar thing that we don't have in any other subject. Every university in the country has not only an economics department, but also a second department that teaches how the economy works. But it has a different name. It's called a business school. Even though they overlap, we have two different tracks in economics. One for the economics department that's a cheerleader for capitalism, and one for the business school department that is supposed to teach you how markets and businesses actually work. What an admission of the failure of economics to do what it was supposed to do: explore, analyze, and objectively assess the strengths and weaknesses of the economic system in which we live, in the hope and with the purpose of doing better, even if and when that means system change. In a sense, I am saying, politely, shame on the economics profession for having been craven, one-sided, and inadequate in the shadow of the Cold War. The saddest thing is now that the Cold War is behind us for over 20 years, the economics profession has yet to catch up. We've come to the midpoint of our program. We will be back with the second half of Economic Update. Please stay with us. We will be back shortly. Welcome back. This is the second half of this week's edition of Economic Update. I am your host, Richard Wolff. We are in the midst of our major discussions of important topics. And then towards the end of the program, as we always do, we will address some of the questions that have come in through our websites. And a word on those again. We have two websites. We ask you to make use of them. They are available 24/7 at no charge whatsoever. rdwolf.com and democracyatwork.info. In addition to providing you with elaborations of everything we do on these programs and a complete archive of all of our programs over the last 3.5 years, the websites give you a chance to communicate with us about radio stations where we might discuss with them carrying our program, about visits I might make to the area where you are listening or watching that I'm more than happy to consider doing, to communicate to us what you'd like the program to cover, questions, criticisms, all of it. You can do that through the two websites, and you can also follow us, as we ask you to do, on Facebook, Twitter, and Pinterest. Once again, rdwolf.com and democracyatwork.info. My next longer discussion takes the form of a report. Indeed, a report from a city I visited over the last couple of weeks, and where I talked about something that deserves some extended conversation with you here and now. The city I visited, Santa Fe, the capital of the state of New Mexico. I went there at the request of local people who are engaged in a campaign that I find impressive. In fact, I'd use the word inspiring. My hat is off to the people who organized the conference where I spoke and to the remarkable job they have done of putting forward a powerful campaign that is gathering lots of support and is giving a way forward for the state of New Mexico, unlike anything that they have seen in quite a while. The conference was about, and by the way, it was called Banking on New Mexico. And what they wanted was simple. They would like to build a public bank in and for the state of New Mexico. In a sense, they want to do in New Mexico what exists in only one of the other states of the 50 states that make up the United States. That other state is North Dakota. For the last 100 years, North Dakota has had a public bank. And despite the efforts of the big private banks, such as Wells Fargo that we talked about earlier, but not only them, despite the efforts of large banks like that to get rid of a public bank that competes with them, they have failed. Repeated governments, Republicans and Democrats alike in North Dakota, have resisted calls to get rid of the public bank because it is socialist, or to get rid of the public bank because it competes with private enterprise. All of that fell on deaf ears. Republicans and Democrats alike said, no, 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 we're staying with our public bank. And now the people of New Mexico have begun to see that this is an idea whose time has come. What's the point? Very simple. And I'm going to use the example of North Dakota to drive the point home, because there we have the proof over 100 years of what such a bank can do. The basic idea is this. The state government takes all of the money that comes into it, the taxes people pay, the driving licenses fees they pay, the hunting license fees they pay, you name it. All the money gathered by the state is taken in North Dakota and would be used in New Mexico if this campaign there succeeds, not to be made a deposit into the big banks that other states use. In other words, the state money paid in as taxes by the taxpayers and fee payers of the state of New Mexico would go into a Bank of New Mexico, like the Bank of North Dakota. It wouldn't be deposited in Bank of America or Citibank or any of the other monsters that control the banking industry in the United States. And why is that important? Because where you deposit your money means you're giving those people the authority, the right, the duty to lend that money out, but now not as with Bank of America or Wells Fargo, lending out the money not to make profit for the bank. No, 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 that's not what you're doing. A public bank has a different mandate, a different project. Its job is to lend out the money sent into the state for the benefit of the people of the state. The money doesn't leave the state. The money isn't lent to make private profit for the bank. Because even if it were, even if the Bank of North Dakota makes some profit, and of course they make some, that profit is going back into the treasury of the state. And it means the state doesn't have to raise taxes on people, because the money it needs to operate can increasingly come from whatever profits the banks earn. So either the bank lends to the people of North Dakota, in the case of the last 100 years, or it lends to the people of New Mexico if their program succeeds. And they all benefit that way, individuals, small businesses, and so on. Even smaller banks in the state can partner with the big state bank and get opportunities that the big private banks don't give them, because they have to compete with them. So you can begin to see the people of the state benefit two ways. They get a bank much more friendly to them, much more willing to help build industries and businesses that are in the state, that hire people in the state, that serve to build the economy of the state. And if they make a profit, it lowers everybody else's taxes, because the government takes that profit and uses it instead of having to raise the taxes to pay for what the government does. For the people of the state, it's a win-win situation. The loser, of course, is the big monster banks, into whose vaults all the 50 states, excepting North Dakota, have put all their money, which comes to many billions of dollars. Those big banks, you know, the ones we've already bailed out with billions, the ones whose behavior has caused such trouble, the ones who recently have paid many billions in fines for laundering money, for charging excessive fees, for manipulating interest rates in the LIBOR scandal, who are currently about to be hit with fines for manipulating the foreign exchange market, those banks lose. The misbehavior ones, the bailed out ones lose, but the people of each of the states that has the courage to do this are the winners. Wow. A public bank is a project whose time has come. It is 100%+ justified. It is a correct movement forward. The only losers are those who should have been diminished in their role in the economy anyway, given the crisis their behavior brought on us, given the cost to all of us of the bailouts that they have gotten for themselves. What arguments really are left against it? Well, the reason it hasn't happened in other states is, I am proud and pleased to be able to say, fading. The fear, the worry that doing something like this will bring down the wrath of those big banks, the fear that something like this will be called every name imaginable by those who don't want it, that fear is diminishing. That's what the courage and the movement in New Mexico teaches us, just like the courage of the people of North Dakota teaches the lesson. I'm happy to tell you also that there are a number of other states, and indeed a number of cities, because a public bank can be organized on a citywide basis, it can be organized on a statewide basis, and here's a hint, it can be organized on a national basis. Many other countries have that. One of the guests at the conference in New Mexico was a banker from Germany. And he came and he gave a talk, and I had a long conversation with him afterwards, where he expressed his surprise as a visitor from another country, because he says in Germany, for many, many decades, huge parts of the banking industry are public banks. The bank he works for is the issuer of 40 million credit cards from a public bank. All the profits that are gained from those credit card usages don't go into the private pockets of private banks. They go into the earnings of the public banks, and they therefore run a magnificent public banking system, and the profits they make go back into the government, requiring it to tax businesses and individuals that much less. If you think about it, and that's what's so important, and that's why I'm talking about it. If you think about it, the real question you're left with at the end of doing some inquiry is why in the world we don't have more public banks at both city and state levels. Why it has taken us so long to come out of the fog of ideological nonsense that something so proven in North Dakota, something so valuable in many other societies, hasn't been tried, debated, and experimented with, as is beginning to happen now. Why hasn't that happened before? And what the lessons are we can learn from that situation. Okay, we're now ready for the final part of our program, which has to do with dealing with questions that have come up. And one of the questions that has come up over and over again, still and all, deserves an answer. The question is this, and the number of you who have sent in questions like this is very large, which is one of the reasons we pick it. Is there a recovery or not, your questions ask? And if there is, who's recovering and who isn't? Well, the answer to this is unambiguous. For the majority of people in the United States, and by the way, this is also true in Europe, there is no recovery, there has been no recovery, and there is no recovery in sight. For a tiny group of people, you can call them the 1%, you can call them the top 10%, but we're talking in that range somewhere, and the numbers vary, and it's not that important, really, if you think about it, what the exact percentage is. But clearly, a small, if not tiny, minority of people in capitalist economies in North America and in Europe have recovered. Their wealth has recovered in the sense that it's back to what it was before the crisis of 2007 hit. And likewise, their shareholdings and the stock market where they buy and sell shares from one another has recovered from where it was in the collapse of 2008 and 9. Big corporate profits have recovered. But those are all the same people. The richest people are those who sit at the top of our corporations. The stocks are what are purchased and sold by the richest individuals and the biggest corporations on the stock markets of the world. The only addition we'd have to make is it's foreign individuals, corporations, and governments, as well as those inside the United States and each individual country. How can I find a statistic that summarizes what has happened to the mass of people? Well, there are several candidates, but the one I find most persuasive is to look at the income of the median household. Now, what is the median household? That's the household exactly in the middle, meaning 50% of households do less well than this median, and 50% of households do better than this median. So it's the household that gives us a sense of what the middle is. Remember, half households do less well, half do better. What has happened to the median income of households in the United States over the last few years? The answer here is unambiguous. I am using the statistics issued by the United States Census Bureau, and it does something called a current population survey. It does it every few years, I believe it's every 3 years, between 1968 and 2014. So we have a good record. And here's what it shows, that the median household income, basically since the end of World War II, reached a peak around the year 2000. And that median, at around that time, using dollars that have been adjusted for the prices you have to pay, so it's a sense of the real median income, as we call it, reached a peak of about $57,000 per household in the year 2000. What is it today, or as of 2013, the latest full year for which we have statistics? It is $51,000. Right? So from roughly 56 to roughly 51. That's a drop of 10%. You want to get a little more accurate, probably around 9%. But it's a drop from 2000, and an even steeper drop, in a sense, from 2007, when things really went downhill. They went slowly downhill from 2000 to 2006, and then they really took a dive. There's no recovery. The line is almost a straight line down. Has a little bit of wobble, but it's clear that we have not recovered. The median income, the income in the middle, is 9 or 10% less today than it was before the crisis. That's not a recovery, not even close. And that means half of American families did even worse than what I just said. They're not even 10% down. They're more than that down. It therefore is clearly mathematically the case that a very big majority of American households are living at lower incomes, real incomes in terms of what they can purchase, than they did before this crisis hit. No recovery for the majority. Now, some people like to quarrel with this because it contradicts what they would like to believe. Political leaders, from the president on down, want to say, look at how good a job we're doing. We have a recovery going on. They want to believe it, and so they say it over and over again. So to corporate leaders who don't want folks to believe, which is the case, that they've done real well, but at everybody else's expense, that the stock market is booming, but not the average people. They don't want that. They don't like it. And as is so often the case, they substitute their wish for an accurate analysis. I'm not going to do that, and you don't want to hear that, and rightly so. So I'm telling you that the majority of people are worse off. Well, another kind of quarrel besides simply asserting it is say, well, the statistics are wrong. We have more people living in single-family households. That's true, single-adult households, because more and more people are not getting married or getting divorced and living in a household by themselves or with one or two other adults. And that has to be factored in to adjust. No doubt it does, but it is nowhere near big enough to undo the basic picture. Moreover, when you have a person living in a single household, yes, it may mean that you get a lower number, but it's also a kind of extra suffering. Two people who are adults who live together live more cheaply than if they live separately. Everybody knows that. The more quantity you buy, the lower the price per. People who live together economize. They share a bathroom rather than having to maintain the cost of two separate bathrooms, which is more expensive. You factor all of that in, these basic relationships remain the same. So the answer is, the recovery that we have had has only benefited the top 1 to 10 to 5%. The very people who sit at the peak of this economy, who bear most of the responsibility for the crisis, have made sure that the government bailouts and the government help after the crisis hit concentrated on them, helped them first and foremost, and has left the majority of people in the dust. That's how capitalism works these days, and that's why it's long overdue for a questioning and a challenge and an honest debate. The final question for which we will have time today is also a question that a number of you have asked. You've wanted me to talk about how we might imagine a transition from the kind of capitalist economy we have today, private enterprises competing in markets, producing the kinds of inequality and so forth that we talk about on these programs. How do we go from that to an economy in which the typical enterprise was a worker self-directed enterprise, a worker co-op, an enterprise radically different from capitalism because it involves the democratic decision-making of all the people who work there, not a tiny number at the top who are called major shareholders and boards of directors, but everybody. We bring democracy to the enterprise. How can or will that happen? And many of you add the secondary question, won't the capitalists oppose it as something different and maybe something threatening to them? Well, here's my answer. I look for guidance on how a transition could occur from a capitalist economic system to one characterized by democratized enterprises, by co-ops, and by the relationships between people and the co-ops where they work and the co-ops with one another. I look for guidance on how to think that through by looking at the last transition, the one that brought us capitalism out of feudalism. Because before we had capitalism as a dominant system, we basically had feudalism, certainly in the Europe that most of us focus on to try to ask these questions about, mostly Europe and North America. Not that the other parts of the world aren't just as important and have their own and distinct histories. But focusing for a moment on the United States and particularly Europe, They had a feudal system, a system of lords and serfs, a system that wasn't characterized by markets, that wasn't characterized by hiring people. Nobody hired anybody for most of feudalism. You were born on a farm. You worked on that farm. You had the lord of that area that you were loyal to. That was the way the system worked. Well, guess what? When that system began to have more and more troubles, people decided to leave the farm and run to the city, and to set up in the city new and different ways of relating to one another as they tried to cope with a feudalism that was breaking down without knowing exactly where to go. They ended up forming little businesses. And in those businesses, they entered into employer-employee relationships. Over time, they grew. Sometimes the feudals liked that there was a place in the city which was developing and that they could have some relationship to. Other times the feudal lords were enraged and attacked them. It took a long time, but over time these capitalist enterprises grew, survived, and eventually fought with the feudal leftovers, overthrew them, got rid of feudalism, and established a capitalist economic order. I think, roughly, that capitalism is now experiencing ever deeper, ever bigger problems, crises, inequalities that are not sustainable, and that we are looking at co-ops and workers forming their own enterprises without a capitalist, without the people who become rich at everybody else's expense running the enterprises. They're beginning to move in a direction, and my expectation is we'll see more and more of it, that there will be some capitalists who come to terms with this, there will be some capitalists who fight it, that there will be struggles of a difficult sort, but that the handwriting is on the wall, and that we ought to understand that the sooner we form the new direction, the better and the safer, in the end, we all will be. Thank you very much for your attention. This is Economic Update. I'm your host, Richard Wolff, and I look forward to being with you again next week.